So, based on what? Based on what study? Based on what conclusion? Is this just your opinion? Is this your faith? Is this your belief? I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that we could argue this till the cows come home, where I could say, well, no, there is something meaningful about when you kiss the person you love in the real world versus somebody, the person you love in the artificial world. There's something
Is there a difference there? Yes.
No, I don't know.
Wait.
Is there a difference? Yeah.
Yes, there is a difference. When you're actually touching their lips and when you're not touching their lips, there's a difference there.
Well, if you're touching their virtual lips versus
their lips. Yeah, because you're touching a different part of it, right? You're touching their digital representation versus their actual body.
Exactly. Right? So then you are saying there's a difference.
But I'm saying it doesn't make a difference. The difference doesn't go very deep. And I mean, this is an important point. So let's start from the beginning. The idea is that what makes something artificial is that it's man-made, and what makes something natural is that it's not man-made, right? So the wind, the hurricanes, the sun shining, this is not stuff that we created, and so it's natural. And the Matrix and my video game.
Well, I don't want to get off on a tangent too badly here, but I mean, you got human made. I'll be more PC than you for once. And then you've got natural. But then you've got beaver made. Maybe that makes me less PC if I want to be disgusting. And then you've got anthill made. You've got other animals that make things in the world. And that's not natural either by definition, right?
No, what is natural?
That's the real weird question. What about an Inuit making an igloo? Is that a natural construction?
Yes.
Because it's an animal making something with its surroundings and not manipulating them in any way.
So I'm just giving you the traditional definition. The traditional definition is that man-made objects are unnatural in some way that everything else in the natural world is not, right? So the beaver's dam, the bird's nest, the beehive, the ant colony, these are natural insofar as they're not...
And the igloo.
The thing made by human beings, the thing that is man-made. So the thing that's man-made there is non-natural, right? The igloo is non-natural. And the justification for this goes back to maybe Aristotle, but one of the clearest sort of definitions of this is given by Marx in his Anthropology. Marx says that what distinguishes... let me look up the exact quote. I can find it really quickly.
Okay.
Right, so it's what distinguishes the worst of the architects from the best of the bees is that the architect builds his cell in his mind before he constructs it in reality, right? So the idea is that what makes man-made things different from the things that animals make and the things that the natural world does is that in human beings there's planning, there's a design process, right? We have to construct in our mind.
Which I mean, Marx is being arrogant to a degree about the intelligence of humans. We know that there are animal intelligence, right?
There's
a learning curve to building a beaver dam, I would assume. And, a baby beaver is not going to just come out of the womb being able to do that. So there is learning and there is planning, I think. They don't come out of the womb knowing how to do it,
but they don't need to learn how to do it either. They don't have to learn from watching other things do it. They can do it instinctually, right? Animals have instincts also. This isn't to say that animals aren't intelligent, but that their intelligence doesn't consist of a prior process of planning, right? And this is the whole, the whole history of philosophy is addressed in this idea that what thought is this intermediary step between my instinct, my sort of animal instincts and the things that I do in the world. With animals, the idea is that these things are very closely linked. My instincts simply inform what I do in the world. Whereas with humans, our minds intervene. There's this intermediary process whereby we think and we can plan and we can design and we can do it better, right? And part of this thinking process is learning from others and seeing what's been done before and improving on those designs. But only in humans do you have a process like innovation, for instance. Innovation is something that's unique to humans. Birds do not innovate nests. Beavers do not innovate dams. The Inuits do innovate their igloo design. They get better doing it as they do it more, right? And as several generations go by, right? So this is the right. So it's minds, not just intelligence, right? Bees might be smart at doing certain things, but they don't have this intermediary step of planning it out, right? And so what makes humans different is that we construct in our minds before we erect it in reality, and
What about the squirrel that stores nuts for the winter? That's an instinctive thing, but that's also sort of like a planning. Like it knows it has to know the seasons or something.
The scrolls have to have incredibly complex cognitive mechanisms for remembering where they stored their nuts and being able to find them again and all this kind of stuff, right? But they can do this instinctually. They can't do it right outside the womb because they're mammals, and mammals take a while before they become adults. But if you put a squirrel out by himself, without any other squirrels around, the squirrel will learn how to, will figure out how to put nuts in the ground and remember where they are. It doesn't need to learn this from a process of education. It can do this instinctually, right?
Okay.
Right. And so the idea is that what makes something artificial is that it's man-made, and it requires this process of thought. And everything in the natural world is not man-made, is non-thinking, right? Nature doesn't have a mind. Nature doesn't have a mind of its own. Nature just does what it does because of the physical laws, the natural laws that govern what it does. And this includes the animals. It's important to distinguish between what's artificial and what's synthetic. So, for instance, I always get confused on how this works. So a synthetic dye is still a dye. It can still dye things, right? But something that's artificial is not the real thing, right? So a synthetic thing is the real thing. It's just sort of made by people. An artificial.
Well, no, it sounds like synthetic is the thing that will still is perfectly functional to do, like a synthetic dye will still dye clothes, but it's not made from
natural dye.
It's not pigments that are found in berries or whatever.
It's engineered, right? We have some engineering process where we make these dyes, right? So
like with artificial flavoring and synthetic artificial coloring and all those sorts of things for foods and whatnot, you know, like lemon heads or yellow number 7.
Whereas artificial things can be sort of fakes of the real thing, right? So an artificial Van Gogh, for instance, isn't a real Van Gogh. It's a fake, right? It doesn't do the exact same thing. Yeah. It's something different, right?
The weird part, I mean, that's a whole other tangent, though, is whether people that can, if they can spot the difference or not, whether they would appreciate it any less or any more, you know?
Right.
Art forgery. Right.
So at the bottom of this idea of artificiality is this idea that what makes it different is that it's man-made. Now, earlier you said that the difference between the Matrix, which is an artificial world, and the real world of Central Park or whatever, isn't that it's man-made, but that the Matrix is digital. So I think this way of drawing the distinction isn't going to work. It's not going to work, for instance, because I've written a lot of papers. All of my papers, a significant percentage of my papers, have not been printed out on paper. They exist only as digital files on my computer or on my flash drive or something. Right? Does that make them fake? Does that make them not real papers? No, they're real papers, right? I've really written them.
Yes. No, that concept, I mean, you're talking about information being stored digitally. Yeah, that you know, if the appreciation of it is through like a natural means, I guess, through someone's eyes looking at it.
Mere fact that it's,
but we're not talking about just information, are we?
Well, maybe we are, right? So the idea is that the mere fact that it's digital doesn't make it not real. It just means that it's in a different medium. It's not.
That's true. And it is a different thing than that paper written by you by hand.
Sure,
on
I can.
Paper.
Right.
And the appreciation of that by a professor looking at that is going to get two entirely different experiences. First of all, professor reads your digital paper, which is written in, I don't know, let's say Times New Roman. What's your favorite font? They keep everybody the same, right? They say it's got to be this because they still do all that shit about page length and double spacing.
Times New Roman,
right?
I think I use Calibri because that's the default on the newest Word, but yeah, I mean, whatever.
Okay, so the point is there are some font choices, but you're not given any of those, but that's not really what relevant to the discussion. But so even let's say you've got font choices, you've got font size choices and everything in the digital, that's one thing. And then you've got handwritten. And if you hand wrote that, there's going to be, you know, you started writing part of it and you were having a cup of coffee and there's a little coffee circle on the side of it. And then there was, you know, you wrote one of it really too fast and you misspelled it and you put a line through it and had to rewrite it. And professor is going to get more information about your mindset and your attitude and your passion or whatever from reading a handwritten paper than they are from reading the digital paper. There is a, you can appreciate this, that there is a difference in the appreciation of that information depending on the media on which it was delivered. So the digital the digital paper emailed to the professor is, I would say, even different to the printed out paper left in the professor's box. But I don't need to go. But I'd rather go further and say way different and more be more obvious about it than the one that is handwritten.
Right.
That's a different experience to appreciate.
A different experience, but that doesn't mean that one is more legitimate than the other, right?
I was never arguing about legitimacy. I was just arguing that in the natural world, people are used to, we're more used to, and less and less, you're right, we've adapted with this typed thing, you know, and this digital thing. That's all adaptation, you're right, but there is still a difference right there. I mean, I've got handwritten letters from people like my grandfather, my grandmother, and stuff, and those, I mean, like, if you have to keep those, you have to put them somewhere, you have to think about where they are. When you read them, you have to, you know, interpret the writing. It's just a completely different experience, and I think a superior experience to, you get more from that information, I'm saying, than you do from the digital information. I'm saying, and so in your analogy, and that's just what we're working with here, is just that analogy, I still think I can hold to the fact that you get more from a natural, a quote-unquote natural experience than you do from a digital experience. You still, I mean, yeah, you're right, you still probably get 95% of the same stuff, maybe, but I mean, in some cases, maybe less than that, maybe even in some cases more. I mean, if you wrote in a very automatic kind of fashion, the handwritten one might not be all that different, but it would still
be different. So there's certainly a difference. It's not a difference in legitimacy. It's not just more information also, because there can be a lot more information in a digital file. For instance, I have all my students turn in papers to my email, because when I respond to them, I mark up their papers in Word. I use the comment feature in Word, because it's a lot easier to get their comments back, where I don't have to use a pen and paper and take up space. I can just append it to the same document.
How does that work to communicate that? I don't know anything about that. Is that like red font within the text of
It's red font.
So it just inserts your notes so they don't have to like interpolate like where what you're talking about is on
the
paper.
There's also little things that look like speech bubbles that are on the side of the page, like that are in the margins of the page. That I can put notes on and sort of point to the area of the text that I'm talking about.
Okay. So it's pretty easy to interpret. Now within that, I mean that's a font choice thing and everything else too. But then the interpretation of the student getting back the red marked up with pen thing, where the teacher has frustratingly wrote something in all caps, maybe with an exclamation point. Because it's like, you keep doing this. And then they're underlining that thing. That's like, wow, the student appreciates that like thing. It's like, it's a much more visceral appreciation than just, you know, you keep doing written.
Although red ink can sometimes serve freak students out.
Of course. Everyone, I know the whole red ink thing. Yeah, I used blue ink when I rewrote someone's script just recently.
I like turning back bloody red papers, but... but I've been doing it digitally, and the difference is just in the medium, right? You can do certain things with paper that you can't do on your computer, and you can do certain things on your computer that you can't do on paper, and they're just different media, right? The media is the message. The mediums are different, and so you can do different things. But this isn't a deep distinction, right? It's not that the digital version is fundamentally lacking in certain ways. It's just different in terms of its capacities, right? Which is exactly what you've been arguing. Is just these are different sort of things. Well, they have different purposes and functions and possibilities of use and so on, right?
But what I'm also arguing is that not only are they different, but the humans can not necessarily humans can distinguish the difference every time. But I'm saying that the difference is an important thing to humans. It's not always like the big, you know, like 90% of the time you probably don't give a shit.
Right.
But sometimes it's the idea of the face-to-face meeting. It's all of that other stuff that, I mean, is becoming less and less an issue, I guess, as people adapt and get more pragmatic. Like you said, it's totally more practical for you to grade stuff digitally. That makes way, and it's more practical for the student to get it that way. Maybe if the interface is good, it sounds like it's pretty easy to look at and work with and understand and edit.
Right.
And
so when we're dealing with the difference between analog and digital information, what we need to look at is, what are you doing with it? What are your purposes? What are your plans? And, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? And which media suits those purposes better, right? And that's all. Exactly. And that's all you're looking at, right? So this distinction, so the digital analog distinction, isn't going to get us at the heart of the artificial real distinction or the artificial natural distinction.
Well, no, because we're talking about the biggest thing, which is life. We're saying, okay, is there a difference between a life lived in the artificial digital world versus a life, and that's the whole thing. Because if you think about it, even in the Matrix, they had computers. So they were still creating an artificial distinction within the Matrix between a handwritten note and a typed up email or something like that. So, I mean, those things, but that is a huge thing.
Okay. So it's
everything.
So we still have this distinction between the artificial and the natural. The artificial is man-made. The natural is not. The Matrix is an interesting case here because the Matrix is not man-made. The Matrix is machine-made.
Which is man-made. So I mean, in a lot roundabout way.
No. When a machine makes something, and a person didn't make it, then the machine made it. In the same way that, look, your parents made you, but if you make, you know, if you write a script, your mom didn't write that script in a roundabout way. You wrote that script because you wrote that script, right? I mean, right.
Okay, sure. So there's a complete autonomy. Right.
So leave that point aside for a second. I want to call into question that there's any strong distinction that you can make between what is man-made and what is not, right? So I already did this little bit. Central Park. Is it man-made? Well, you want to say no? These are trees, and you know, it's the natural.
No. We were talking. That was back when we were still working on the definition between natural and artificial and all that. So I mean, I'll give you that. Yeah, Central Park is man-made, 100%. You know, it, like I said, it was engineered. They decided to plant a tree there. It's man-maintained. Okay. To give a certain look. So yeah, I could. I have no problem admitting that is an artificial, but still natural environment. There's still real sunlight hitting you on the face, and it's real grass growing. It's not astroturf or whatever sort of thing. You know, I mean, there's a difference between something that, like, I mean, I'm sure they've got them somewhere. Maybe they don't have them at this point because it probably just isn't cheap. But like a completely fake plastic trees and everything else.
I mean, Disneyland's close enough to this. Example of this is those ski resorts that are in Dubai that are completely indoor with like artificially created snow and so you can go in there and you can ski all day because it's a ski resort. But it's in the middle of the fucking Middle East desert right now.
That's weird.
So the question is, what do you have? And this is a very important question. The question is, what do you have to do for it to become man-made versus something natural? This is an important question because this is at the very root of our notion of property. Right. So back when John Locke was writing, when the founders of the Constitution and stuff were talking about property. Property is exactly the process of mixing your labor with the land, right? So there's the uncharted wilderness out to the west of America, and you can own that land if you go out there and you do something with it, if you cultivate it, if you plant your seeds there, if you build a fence around the portion of land that you want, right? Because you did something to that land, because you mixed your labor with that land, it's yours. It's your property, sure. Right? And the idea...
Or it's your responsibility. I mean, maybe that's just the way it's been expanded upon now. I mean, like I said, we've got property out here that is, I would say, there are sections of it that are pretty untouched by man, you know, as places. Because it's, you know, it's 8 acres. It is what it is. It's in the redwoods. There's a lot that is man manipulated.
Is it fenced in? It's not fenced in, is it?
No, it's not. It doesn't need to be. It's our property, though. I mean, you know, we own it, so we have legal property rights on it for the time being.
Right, and property, more than anything else, was understood in terms of land, right? So maybe you didn't actually cultivate it, but you reserve the right to cultivate it, and you've cultivated things around it and nearby it, right? Your house lies on that land also, and you built the house, and so the land that house sits on is yours. The land surrounding it, and somewhere I'm sure there's a map that says exactly where your land ends.
Right. Yeah. That's all kept at the county records and all that stuff. You know, with property lines.
So land is this a very clear case of when something becomes man-made. When you've mixed your labor to some extent with that land, when you've done something to that land, it becomes yours. It becomes man-made property and not just untamed wilderness. But where is that line, right? So the question is, where is that line? Where is the line between what is untamed nature and what is man-made artificial world? And when I say I deny that there's any distinction,
sounds like it's a spectrum and not a line. Maybe I don't really know. You know,
Like
you've got the Dubai ski resorts, which are pretty obvious. You've got Central Park, which is a little less obvious, but still pretty manipulative. And then you've got like my house out in the Redwoods, where there's places that are within it that are clearly by the house and man-made, man-manipulated, you know, lawn and whatnot. And then you've got walk out into the trees, and maybe there's a little trail on one corner. But then if you walk off that trail for 5 steps, I don't know if any of us or anybody has ever done anything to that, you know, to manipulate that environment. It's just been what it's been. So, I mean, I'd say it's very much a spectrum of whether or not people have. It's to what degree has there been any human manipulation on a piece of land?
Right. So what counts as the minimal amount of manipulation for it to be?
That's a good question.
Let me run a few test cases by you and see what you think. Say you walk out into the woods where there's no paths or nothing cultivated at all, and there's a downed tree, where the tree, the roots are still in the ground, and there's a little stump there. And say you decide to start forging a path, and so you lay your tools out in that stump and use it as a table. Right? Does that count as making an artificial?
I'll make this easy for you. You know, let's just sound a thunder it. And as soon as I stepped off my path, I affected the world around me, and therefore there was a new interaction going on.
Good.
There.
So
at the very bottom of the spectrum, at the very most minuscule end, if you want to be a nitpick about it, as soon as you were walking, you know, I could be bare ass naked walking through the woods, and I'm crunching on things. I'm disturbing the quote natural ecology and everything else. My presence is affecting it as a man, as a person, as a human being. I'm manipulating it in as whatever minuscule way I need to you know get from A to B or whatever the task is at hand. Like you said, the table thing is what it is if you decide to set your tools down there. But then it's even more obvious when you decide to cut something down or start forging the path because you're
right.
Affecting it there. But just walking through it is affecting
it. So just walking through it, right.
And deciding how to walk.
Yeah, so that's right. So just walking through it affects it. But it doesn't affect it in the design sense because there's no, or you might think that there's no deliberate process of design, right? There's not none of this thought going on that mediates.
Well, from what?
From you, right? You're just walking, right?
Well, no. There's because this is what distinguishes, you know, us from the animals, right? According to old Marx, right? Is I am looking at the environment and saying, well, what's the clearest path? You know,
right. So if you're stuck with this,
let's stick with me being naked. I don't want to get my junk caught up on some sticker bushes, so I'm going to walk away from those. So I do design a path in my mind that is the best path.
That's why it's easily
the craziest, lowest spectrum. Once humans manipulate it, they manipulate it. There you go. You got me there.
If that's the case, then there is no natural world. Because everything...
Well, there are still parts that haven't been manipulated.
But we haven't been there yet, right? If we haven't been there yet, then we don't know... I mean, then...
Okay, so it's a perception thing. If we have not yet seen it, then it is not... You know, it's...
So there is no natural world if...
A little Heisenberg going.
If all it requires is being there, affecting it in some way... Heisenberg, right? Just seeing it is affecting it in some way, right? Our satellites in the sky taking pictures of every square inch of land on the Earth.
I don't know. I wouldn't be that extreme with the satellite thing. I think that actually is a good way around that, because you can take a picture of something and you're not really doing anything. From a design standpoint, you're not doing anything to it, because me physically walking through it, like I said, I am having a physical effect on the environment. But taking a photograph from space. I mean, I guess it's bouncing photons off of.
Well, those are photons that are already bounced off of it. You're just capturing.
Exactly. You're capturing them. So I would say that no. So it's possible to observe quote, perfectly natural, untouched by man environments at this point now. We've achieved that level with our technology.
Untouched environments. Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, like you said, there's no man-made design element to those environments. How could there be? There's never been people there to design anything. Not even a guy running around naked, just on instinct, at the same time planning ahead an intelligent path through woods and trees and briar bushes and whatnot.
See, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that observing it is a way of mixing your labor with it.
Sure. And so that could be some property thing, but let's get back to this idea of design. Because design requires, like you said, especially from man-made, it requires forethought and intention and intellect and all of that. And if you're just taking a photograph of something, you are not affecting anything. You are not, you're just looking at it. It's completely passive. You didn't step into it, and you didn't, you know, you just... I mean, you could say that you chose what position to take the photograph from, and maybe there's a perception issue, but that just has to do with how you're seeing the environment. That doesn't have to do with how you qualify the environment or categorize it. It's unman-made. There was no design done, no effect on design. Right? Doesn't that concept of design, isn't that crucial to the idea of something being man-made?
Right.
And I even gave you the naked guy running through the woods. Nothing but the guy in the woods.
I'm
with nothing, and he's designing a path,
right?
Because he's thinking about how to get through stuff. That makes sense to me. And I'll call that man.
I'm very skeptical that there's any such thing as design. Go back to the guy who sets his tools out on the stump of a tree. That requires very, very little forethought, right? Because what you're really thinking about is the path that you're about to forge, and you just need a place really quickly to set your stuff, and you just, oh, there's a stump, I'm going to put my stuff there. There's very little thought process that goes into that use of that environment, because what you're really thinking about is something else, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm sorry, but maybe I'm the wrong person to ask these kinds of questions to. But I mean, you kind of got to think, well, okay, you got to allocate a place for your tools. It's not going to be in the way and going to be easy access to. You know, there's perpetual compromises and trade-offs in every action you take. You know, your objective is to forge a path. You require a place for these tools that will, one, be... easy access, and two, be close to where you're working, and three, not have the tools be in your way. You know, you're constantly trading off these different things. You see an open space where there's a
right.
a stump, and does that correspond to the place where you want to build the path and all that other questions come up. You're like, that would be great for me to set my tools there. Unfortunately, the path is actually about five steps over that way. So I'm saying that there's a situation where that could not be a convenient thing, and so there is forethought going into that.
Right. No. I'm not denying that there's forethought. But the idea is that it takes very, very little for it to for you to move it from the natural world into this artificial sort of man designed.
We already did
without tools
or anything.
I think this is important because it has lots of ramifications for the way that we think about property, especially in the digital age. There's a huge problem right now with intellectual property, music being traded around online and so on. The idea is that our old notions of property really don't apply to digital media because... everything I do with digital media is a way of mixing my labor with that media. When I download a song, when I'm sitting on a torrent, for instance, part of my bandwidth, part of my computer cycles that I paid for are being invested in the distribution of that song. Maybe this...
No. You've got a little bit of a point there to a degree, but at the same time, you're so stuck on this idea... this definition that maybe, like I said, already has flaw to it. Property being defined as strictly being what object plus labor, or what is the definition in the digital age if it's not land?
Yeah. It's something that I've mixed my labor with. Mixing your labor with, yeah.
Okay, mixing your labor with something, sure. But I mean, it's also sort of there's a greater complexity to it. I don't think labor is necessarily even required to define it as because you can pay other people to tend your property, And you can also not tend your property. You can, I mean, the implication is that there's a responsibility on you to place some labor into that environment because it's yours, but that doesn't mean you will, or that you have to, or that you're obligated to in order for it to legally be considered yours. Squatters can't, like, say I don't mow my lawn, squatters can't come hang out on my house and then mow my lawn and then be like, look, I put the labor into this, now it's my property.
Certainly that's right, but squatters, if you live on land for long enough, then it becomes yours, right? Like 14 years.
Well, there's
right,
a grandfathered right. In thing, yeah. That may or may not apply.
Paying someone to mow your lawn is a way of, I mean, because you're the one that's doing the designing, right? You're the one your labor is being represented by the money that you're paying other people to do it, right? So, sure.
That's a sort of long way around it. But
if you have
land,
you don't cultivate, it can be co-opted. Eminent domain style by the government, right? If you don't mow your lawn, then they can eventually, I guess.
Neither one of us are legal scholars in all the craziness with eminent domain. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, there some of that stuff can and some of it can't. But I would say that it's all still gray area type stuff. And that in terms of like artistic property and stuff, I mean. How does that relate to things that aren't digital? That's a whole different debate, though. I don't know if I really want to get into that right now. You know, the idea of paying for a taxi to go to an art show to look at somebody's art. You know, I mean, you're putting labor into the idea of going to an art show, but that, you know, that person still created that piece of art. You don't feel like you have some ownership on that, do you?
Maybe, although art now is increasingly interactive and, you know, but yeah, this is probably way too far afield. I have more stuff to say about artificial versus natural, but maybe this can wait until we look at maybe another movie at some point in the future.
So did you want to get to this last little bit and give any of our poor listeners that have been through all this already some sense of where you so you're saying that your big statement where we were kind of at odds, it seemed, was there's no. It's not no meaningful difference between. I mean, I hate to rephrase it because I'm just going to phrase it in a way that's probably wrong. But there's the digital and there's the natural, and you're saying, as far as humans are concerned, that it doesn't matter, or you're saying that there's no meaningful difference, or there's no meaningful appreciation, or there's no distinguishing.
Yeah. You really can't distinguish. I mean, like I tell my students, you go outside, you are in an artificial. You're in a world that's been created by humans. The plants. On the sidewalk, you think are natural?
Yeah, okay. We labored through that enough. I think that's not so much relevant as it is the natural versus the digital. That was where you were going with that, with the email and the letters, and I was still saying, if we're keeping it with the Matrix and everything else from our initial talk, I'm still saying, a good example, I think better examples of this, and I hate to talk about crap like this just because it's the kind of stuff I don't really care about talking about, is things like, you know, like a kiss, like a physical interaction between two people in a natural environment, even if they're at Central Park, in an artificial environment in the natural world, that physical interaction is got more going on probably than the digital representation of that physical interaction.
I
think that's what the theme of the Matrix is basically at. I think that's one of the bigger parts of it. I mean, you got Joey Pants eating the steak saying, my brain is telling me this, blah, blah, blah. He's able to totally have a sensory experience eating that steak. He's able to convince himself because he wants to that much. And I'm saying that I guess if you really wanted to, you could. But if you knew there was a difference, you'd be able to tell. And the Matrix is saying that there are some people that are more adept at telling than others, but that everybody is sort of getting shortchanged no matter what, unless they're just either going to agree to lie to themselves, take the blue pill and not care.
I'm only taking the moderate position that there's a difference, but the difference only matters with respect to what you want to do with it. And kissing someone is something that you can only do when you're in the presence of that person, but having them dance on a webcam for you can be fulfilling for completely other reasons.
That's not okay. Maybe that's a different thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's the point.
Because I was really just saying,
it's just It just depends on what purposes you have. And yeah,
absolutely. And if your purpose is I guess, to, I mean, I don't know. These were problems with the Matrix films and why they're... I think the only reason that you can discuss a lot of these things as problems is because someone like you or like me are looking at it thematically and also looking at it sort of philosophically and everything else and seeing that, like, they're kind of half-assing some of this stuff. And that's just what they do. They just, we have to infer so much about... they could have... And honestly, like, two things that I think would have been great, and maybe they should do more movies, who knows? I mean, at this point, they kind of gave it this real, like, to be concluded, and then it was in the third one, right? I would have loved to have seen the more diversity of environments in the Matrix, which you get in the Animatrix with the kid in the snow out like in what seems like a rural environment, and then he freaks out because like it's that was maybe supposed to be kind of their bizarre Citizen Kane reference to the idealized world, the Rosebud and all that. But you don't get that. You don't get more Cypher-like characters in the sequels would have been good. Some people that were like, I know, I took the blue pill, and I kind of know it's fake, but I'm fine with it being fake. A couple of people like that in the Matrix would have been interesting foils and characters.
The closest thing you do have to that is the Merovingian, who doesn't really care about the human plight at all, right?
Yeah, exactly. But he's sort of an information trader, and he's also so completely been intoxicated by humanity to the point where I don't know if... what's your name is a program, his wife or what, but he's cheating on his wife and it pisses her off, and he talks about the French wine, the French language, and he makes a dessert and all this weird stuff. So he's become to me nothing more than this idea that that a program, if it's lived long enough, is going to just is going to turn and go that route of sort of the hedonism bot or something, those things were interesting, but there were other questions I wanted answered, and those sequels didn't give them to me or even really delve into them too much. Or if they did, they just kind of played them really quickly. And then they, of course, had to do the big thing with Zion and grow more character and do more characters for the sake of giving us somebody to care about on that when that whole half of that third movie was happening. So those are why I think most people have problems with the films and stuff. Though I will say that I enjoyed them more this on a second watching, and I guess I would consider it sort of relevant, and worthwhile. If I were going to watch, in 10 years or whatever, I felt like watching The Matrix again, I probably would watch all of them. I think I'm that way anyway, even if I don't necessarily like the sequels or something, I feel like I would need to be compelled to watch the whole thing.
If you watch the Indiana Jones movies, would you watch the fourth one?
That's a damn good question. What I did with the Indiana Jones movies before the fourth one came out was ridiculous. Like I watched all the series. I found all the series because I remembered I'd liked some of those episodes, but they were good. Really late when I was a kid. The first few when he was a little kid are mostly kind of dumb. But like once he gets into World War One and stuff, they're all really good, like top notch stuff. And so I watched all Indiana Jones ones, and then I watched the Temple of Doom because chronologically that takes place before Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then I watched, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade. I did it all not necessarily in chronological order because there's that one part where the episode of Indiana Jones. Young Indiana Jones, where actually has Harrison Ford and he's telling the story. So, like, if I were doing it chronologically, I would have watched that, I guess, after Last Crusade, because it takes place in the 50s. It takes place in, like, 1950. And then the fourth one takes place in 59. So, like, I went crazy ridiculous with that. And I've done that all now, and then the fourth movie was just, I probably would have less problem with it in years down the road.
No, it's just bad.
So much of the negativity would be like, whatever, they all kind of have elements like that. I mean, I can watch, like, Temple of Doom and still see problems. I mean, they all sort of have some of those elements. But, yeah, there's definitely a distinct, like, badness. And that gets back to artificial versus natural. How great is that? Versus, like, you're looking, it's like, a lot of this feels like sound stages. And it's like, you know what? They actually went to, like, a desert to shoot some of that stuff in those other movies. It doesn't feel... like, they're not really there, are they? This is a lot of CG gophers and and stuff that just, it is, you know, it still doesn't, even within the confines of our movies, we are not satisfied yet with the digital representations of things that are supposed to be real.
The Uncanny Valley.
When you bounce light off, when you bounce light off a real object, I mean, that's just why I value practical effects and stuff so much more than you know, crappy visual right. CG stuff. It takes you right out of the movie. You watch in Rambo 4 and you see that digital blood and you're like, ah, it looks kind of stupid. It isn't as visceral. It isn't as strong as, like, you know, you're watching Total Recall and you see those squibs right. blow up. That's like, you know, some guy actually strapped those onto his, you know, red sugar water or whatever onto his body. And that stuff, I mean, like I said, that I think goes to that argument that there's something that we appreciate that we can't quite get yet at the digital. And you're right. I mean, maybe like it is that Uncanny Valley and everything else. And who knows? Maybe it's asymptotic or maybe it's not. But we don't have the science or anything yet to study that. We don't have the technology yet where we can get to that level. And I mean, I'd imagine once we do and people have adapted to the levels that of that stuff, it will become maybe less and less relevant. Maybe it will just become a moot point, the idea of kissing someone in real life versus kissing someone in the virtual digital world. Maybe it won't matter to those people, to that generation anymore, because they won't know the difference. I mean, it'll be like the difference between, like, people in Generation Zeta, and like our grandparents. Maybe they like the same music. They're listening to Birth of the Cool. That's the one everyone likes. But they're listening to Kinda Blue, and they're listening. You know, the old guy listened to it on vinyl, and the kids listening to it on, you know, 128 kbps right. MP3s. And you know, there's definitely and you can hear it. Maybe you don't hear it.
So,
maybe you do.
So just for your own knowledge, Zeta is not the last letter of the Greek alphabet. It's the sixth letter. Of the Greek.
Well, that means there's 20 more, yeah. I don't know. Right, I mean, Omega right, is right. the last one, right? And that's the whole, like, Generation Omega. I think I went with A, B, C. You know, there were Generation X, and then I figured Generation Y would be us, and then the last one would be Z in that order, and so I figured we'll go with Z for Zeta or whatever. I don't care. But that doesn't mean it's the last generation. Hell, no. There's going to be a few more. That means that we've got this many more iterations before the end of the world, you know? Generation Omega will be the last one, posthumously named by the last human as he stands on the rubble of other things and plants a meaningless flag, cynically. I don't know, whatever's going to happen.
Look upon my work, see mighty in despair.
Yes, exactly. For there is no one to look upon my works.
If we were to do the one after X in the Greek alphabet, it would be Omicron.
Nice, Omicron right. Persei.
All right. So I guess that's it. I don't have anything else to say.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, we will make sure to check out all of your nifty rantings and ravings and posts and links and things at eripsa.org.
Yes.
Correct.
Eripsa.org.
Okay. Well, I've got that thrown in there at least once. I'm going to hack this one up to probably about five pieces too. But that's cool.